I sort of wanted to also bring up here, there was this concept called like experiential deprivation or experiential impoverishment, which it came from, or like sensory deprivation. It came from very specific studies with dogs, actually, and it essentially dealt with like, if you sensorially deprive animals, how do they develop? So it was very basic science, nothing to do with humans. And then this concept slowly came into the human world, and it essentially was saying that, today is saying that, in how we've built our world for a variety of reasons, cultural, historical, economic, we've made our world very much sensorially empty. Sort of think about a newly built cities. I think this is something that's particularly prevalent in the US, for instance, because in Europe we have the, you know, older architecture, but if you go into the US or like the newly built cities, or if you think about fashion shows, trends, think about the cars on the street, even think about the iPhone. Everything is sort of so bland. It's so empty. There's not a lot of richness to it. And this sensory deprivation, this deprivation of sensory stimulation, of information coming at us in a coherent, in a harmonious way, in different directions to send us a message, it's just not there. And it makes us feel nothing.
Welcome to season 4 of Go Out and Talk to Strangers. This is Adi. I'm a nomadic architect and the founder of The New Movement, an architectural design studio that designs one-of-a-kind, innovative, and creative projects worldwide, using the built environment as a tool to help people thrive. During my travels, I am constantly meeting incredible people. People who are reshaping the way we live, work, and connect. The reason I started this show is because I want to highlight the ones who are leading the way. This is the place where I host thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and founders of unique projects to share their stories and insights. I want to invite you to be part of the change. If you're looking for something bigger than yourself, if you also feel that we can do better, and standard is simply not good enough, you're in the right place. I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. On this episode, I had the absolute pleasure to host Natalia Filvarova. Natalia is a neuroscientist and a UX researcher currently at Google working on digital identity systems. She has previously led research efforts in brain images and understanding multisensory processing, as well as designing food for spaceflight and building Alzheimer's sensory diagnostic tools. Natalia has previously built startups as well as founded education and communication nonprofits. She is an Oxford and LMU neuroscience graduate, as well as MBA holder, a TEDx speaker, and an advocate for accessible and inclusive design and workspace practices. Finally, I can geek out with a neuroscientist on the show. So join us if you want to know more about how humans are wired, how do we perceive the world, and how we can design with our senses to create better results. Let's dive in. Natalia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
It's so wonderful to have you here. And actually, it's the first time that I have a neuroscientist on the show.
Nice.
Yeah, very exciting. How are you today before we start?
I am good. It's incredibly hot in Berlin today. But other than that, other than unusual heat for August, it's a great day. I'm just gone back from vacation, so I'm feeling refreshed and all is well.
That's amazing. Thank you for making the time and for joining us here. And I think today's episode is going to be extremely interesting having you with us. So thanks again for that. How about we start from a little bit understanding what drew you into this field of knowledge and what is your own personal... I see I'm blacking out because I'm excited.
That's okay.
Can you share a bit about your background and what brought you into doing what you do today?
Of course. So I currently work as a UX researcher at Google. But I wasn't sort of always I guess, trained to be a UX researcher. You cannot even, to be fair, but that's a different discussion. And I got to where I am by doing all sorts of random things that were all inspired by the education that I got. And my education was in experimental psychology and neuroscience. And I'll talk in a moment a little bit more about that. But sort of studying the brain and studying how the human mind works got me really excited. I tried to go into traditional science. So I tried to do research kind of in a very, you know, traditional basic sense in a research institute. I tried to do a PhD actually multiple times because I felt like, you know, that is what you do. You study neuroscience and then you go on to do research. And I really wanted to fulfill that, you know, path defined for me, essentially. And then at some point I realized that it's not really my cup of tea because I love science as a concept. I love being data informed. I love getting inspired by research, but I was really lacking this application to the real world and being like, okay, so what? Like, here's a paper, here's a fantastic finding. What am I supposed to do with this now? And sort of that pushed me out of the traditional world of science and more into kind of the world of trying to create products. I've built startups, I've built nonprofits, I've ended up working in tech now. Yeah, so it was all getting inspired by how the human brain works and then wanting to be just a little bit more applied with it and having a more direct, more immediate impact on the world.
That's amazing. I love that. You know, there's so much interesting knowledge out there that we never get to apply in design and in everyday life. And that's why I think this mission is quite extraordinary. So in your work, in your day-to-day work, what is it that you actually do?
Right. So in my day-to-day work, I essentially get to talk to a lot of kids and families. At Google, I take care of doing research, which means sort of understanding what the user needs and in my case, what kids and families need when it comes to their Google account. So my job is to go out there and talk to people, ask them questions, extract meaning from their answers, and then bring it to my team so that we can do our best possible job at applying that knowledge to the Google products. But I do have to say that what I do in my core role, it's only a small part of the things I care about, because I think my sort of my background and my education was a little bit more geared towards sensory perception and more geared towards exactly how the brain works. I think for a variety of reasons, you know, how life gets together, things like visas and money and where the jobs are. I ended up where I am and I love that. But there is this whole part of me that doesn't get to do it on a daily basis. And the it being work with senses, work with human perception, work with how the brain perceives the world. And I sort of try to channel that love and that passion outside of my core role in other projects that I do. So I think there is two sides of me in that.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great and very much needed, the whole sensory perception thing. So let's talk about it. Let's talk about how our understanding of how the human brain and perception of space, how it all wires into our everyday life and our choices.
Yeah, so I think we can get started with the very basics. So since we're little kids, you kind of get taught that there is a couple of senses, right? We have vision, we have smell, taste, we have touch, we have hearing. If you get a little bit more advanced in school or in your books, you hear also about proprioception. That is that feeling of sort of where you are in space and where your body is positioned. But really, that is that. Sort of you learn, you know, as a kid, you learn that, then maybe you get into a little bit more detail of how those things work. But very often in our everyday life, we kind of treat those things as being entirely independent. Like, you know, I see something and I hear something and maybe I touch something. And okay, maybe sometimes, like if I go to the movies, I do both of those things, but we tend not to pay a lot of attention to the fact that the world is actually simultaneously processing all those senses. And this is something that captivated a lot of my interest. And particularly when it comes to design, we forget that the senses always happen at the same time, even if we don't consciously pay attention to them. Like, you know, I might be now sitting talking to you and I'm, you know, looking at the video, but then there is sounds happening outside. There is sounds happening in my room, even. There is maybe some smells I feel in the kitchen. And I tend to ignore that. We all tend to ignore that because we focus on the mainstream of sensory kind of sensory information that goes at us. But in reality, it's not just that. So I think this is one huge thing that we are kind of missing in how we are designing spaces and objects and our experiences, even for ourselves, is that understanding that our perception of the world does not happen in isolated elements, and it's all of these senses coming together. Specifically, it's termed multisensory perception. So it's all of these senses coming together and interacting with each other and making us perceive the world the way it is. It gets even more complex when you pile on top things like memories and emotions and, you know, your experiences that happened during that day, and it all interacts together. But it's this coming of things together and that synergy that happens when you put all of those feelings and senses together that makes us experience the world as it is. And I think there is beauty in that and a lot of opportunity in that for us to leverage it strategically in addition to how it happens just, you know, naturally in the environment where we live.
Such a beautiful explanation. And you know, it's funny because we do experience so many things at the same time as we're going through our lives. But the only times that we're mindful of it, or I think from a business standpoint, is when we're trying to sell people things they don't need.
Yeah.
Like, you know, in retail design and in shelving strategies in supermarkets and all that. But you know, what about well-being and what about creativity and what about all of those parts of our lives that can be amplified through design? But we don't put enough resource and energy into that. So I would love to hear your thoughts about what do you think the future would look like, knowing everything that we know nowadays?
Yeah, so I think you're bringing up one very important point, and this is like a pervasive virus that is just everywhere, where we try to optimize for sales or for KPIs, costs, money, whatever that might be that, you know, a company is doing. And we forget about the fact that there is a human behind it trying to experience things. And we only remember it if it's like you said, you know, oh, can I sell more if I do this? And you're like, oh, okay, I can sell more. I can make this, you know, feel nicer, not just look nicer. And it's probably going to get more sales. You see that very heavily, right? Like in supermarkets where they'll put a smell of bread or something like that to make you more enticed, more hungry, willing to buy more. And it's kind of sad that is the way that we apply this knowledge. It is exciting in some senses, because for a really long time, that wasn't even the case at all. So having that drive to make money is at least bringing attention to this, you know, side of things. So I'll give it credit for that. But you're entirely right that there is an entire world of opportunities to use all of this perception of the world that we have to like make our experiences better on a human level, on an individual level, make us happier and healthier. And, you know, one of the things that always comes to my mind when I talk about these examples is thinking about plants in the houses. It sounds, you know, for me in Berlin, where everybody loves plants, it sounds incredibly boring. Like, of course you have plants in the houses. But then in a lot of sort of, you know, in a lot of apartments, you will go in and you don't see a lot of that greenery because it feels like, well, why do I need it? You know, like I have my kitchen or I have my bedroom and I have this and I have that. Why would I put something extra like a plant in there? You know, I can already see green trees outside or something like that. And there is that entire sort of wealth of experience that is being missed on, because you cannot maybe smell the tree or smell the plant, and you cannot feel how the air changes, and you cannot touch it, and your brain cannot put together all of these different senses because the plants, for instance, are not there. And there is such a wealth of studies that shows that if you do have greenery in your house, the more the merrier, you get, you know, healthier, your mental health gets better, your focus gets better, your attention gets better, and your life gets better. But because it's not something sort of like, you know, immediately relevant or immediately helpful, practically helpful, like this desire to, you know, maximize profits, we can think about it not just in a sense of money, but also in a sense of our efficiency as humans, for example, right? Like, can I maximize my time? Can I maximize whatever the amount of things I'm doing in a day? Things like plants, things like making your house smell nice, they don't immediately contribute to that in a way that is obvious. And we just don't do it, because it's like, why would I waste my money on something that smells nice or something that looks nice if I could buy an extra, I don't know, organizer for my pens, right? Like an organizer for your pens is very clearly helpful because you can be faster at picking your pens. But then there's all of those other things that help your mental and also physical well-being a lot of the times. And I think it's beautiful that the world is moving in the direction. Like, again, I say Berlin is not a really good example because everybody has here plants in the house, but I've been to a lot of homes kind of outside of Berlin where that is not the case. And this awareness is coming through, the awareness to the fact that if you put extra effort, if you put a little bit of extra kind of time and, you know, investment in money or whatever that might be that you're investing into it, and you do stimulate all of your senses with things like plants or smells, you can get a lot out of it for yourself and for your mental and physical health. And particularly sort of there is this, it's called the biophilia hypothesis. It's something that inspired me, particularly because I have to admit I'm really bad at plants, and maybe I brought this example up because I wish I was good at that, but I'm actually really bad at caring for plants because I get overwhelmed with like having to take care of them. And then I read about this thing called the biophilia hypothesis, which is essentially claiming that, you know, we as humans have had millions and millions of years of evolution growing in nature and being connected to nature. And then in the past couple of thousand years, we find ourselves, well, thousands, even hundreds of years, we find ourselves locked in these tiny white, you know, or whatever colored rooms, and we get disconnected from nature. And our minds and our bodies are craving, they are evolutionary craving that connection, that sensory connection to the natural world. And there is so many studies that show that kind of being in the nature and being in the, you know, amongst the trees, and even having green wallpaper in your house impacts your brain in a way that makes you feel healthier and, you know, more focused, more relaxed. I think that is inspiring the world slowly. And that inspired me a lot. That made me feel like I'm sitting here looking at a fake plastic plant because I cannot take care of a real plant. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to make a small step. I'm going to at least put a fake one. And it makes me feel really good. So that was a really long-winded answer to your question of sort of where I see this going.
No, but it was super interesting. And actually, there is an entire movement of biophilic design that draws the information from what you just said. So that's brilliant. You know, we have some studies about how same group of students took the same test in different rooms, one on plastic tables and one on wooden tables. And even the material the table is made of actually affect our performance. So that's beautiful and so useful to know and to integrate into our lives. And it starts from the little thing. I remember you talking about the color of M&Ms when I listened to one of your talks, you know, like color priming.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that because that's very relatable.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So, I just wanted to kind of also bring up, I think this, you know, like we said, right, like why do students feel better or perform better at tests if they're at wooden desks versus plastic desks? It's not some, you know, magical trick or sales motif. Probably it is in some ways, but there was also neurobiological reasons for why that works. And that very heavily has to do with how our brain integrates different sensory informations and then how it puts that together with everything else that it knows. And essentially this multi-sensory integration, and I'll in a moment explain sort of what that is, makes us experience the world in a much richer way and makes us feel more connected to it, more emotionally sort of, you know, awakened, all of the feelings are stronger. And essentially the way that it works is we figured it out through studies where if you, for example, just look at something and then you record how the brain activates, sort of brain activity refers to the fact that, you know, if your brain is processing information, it's doing the work, you can record the signal, and it's called this brain activity signal. And we're essentially saying that like, hey, if there is a particular signal in a certain part of the brain, it means that part of the brain is being very active. And then scientists have all sorts of maps for what parts of the brain do what. That is not important for now. What's important is that if you make people, let's say, look at something, and then you record their brain activity, you have this signal, let's say, let's call it one, right? Signal of amount one. Then you make people listen to something and you record brain activity in a different part of the brain, the one that processes audio, and you have also some amount of signal, let's call it one. If we were to perceive the world how we often think we perceive the world, you know, separately, you would assume that 1 + 1 = 2. If you make people listen to something and look at something, they would have two volumes of activity, you know, like two units of action happening in their brain. But when we've done those neuroscientific studies, i.e. we've measured the activity in the brain of the people, we see that that is not the case. We see that the activity is much stronger. You have this synergy, you have this 1 + 1 suddenly equals 3. You suddenly see other parts of the brain being activated. You suddenly have emotional centers getting activated, even though the sound maybe in itself was completely neutral and the visual stimuli was completely neutral, but you get people to have certain emotions. And there was a lot of hypotheses as to why that happens. One of them being that it brings you kind of, you know, an evolutionary survival advantage to be able to, you know, really put things together and be like, okay, if I see a bear, maybe I'm hallucinating. If I hear a bear, maybe I'm hallucinating. But if I see and hear a bear, okay, there's probably a bear, so I better run. So there was this evolutionary drive behind us putting senses together and really amplifying that experience. And that is why if you are in an environment that stimulates multiple senses, you get those better focuses, better sort of ability to concentrate or experience things or have feelings and stuff like that, because your brain is pulling information and cues from all of those different sources and all of those different kind of stimuli. And it's making you say, okay, a lot of it is happening. All of it is, you know, trying to send me a message. What is that message? I really have to feel that message. And the example that you brought up with M&Ms is probably one of the most prominent ones that just got really popular in the media because it's incredibly easy to show. And it talks about the integration of colors and tastes. And essentially, you can try this at home. You can buy yourself a packet of M&Ms. Oh, see, I'm trying to remember if it's M&Ms and Skittles because they've done both. But, you know, one of those, I think it's M&Ms because I think Skittles actually have different flavorings in them. But, you know, you can try it with both and tell me how it works. But you basically take M&Ms, the ones that are of different colors, and you can eat them with your eyes open and look at them and be like, okay, I think this one tastes of this. I think that one tastes of that. But then if you close your eyes, you suddenly can no longer taste the flavor. It's all the same. You cannot tell apart whether you've picked up a green one or you've picked up a red one. And kind of the idea there is that even though all of the M&Ms are of the same taste, they're all made exactly with the same recipe. It's just the food coloring that's different and it's not actually flavorfully different. It's exactly the same. Because you look at something and your brain is seeing, for example, the color red in this case, it's bringing up all of those associations from the past to being like, okay, red means sweet. And this is a somewhat universal experience, actually, not everywhere, not 100%, but it's generally consistent throughout cultures where, okay, red means sweet and green means sour. And then you take that M&M and it's red and you're like, okay, this is sweet. And then you take a green one and you say, this is sour. And you can try this out at home. And you will kind of see that, you know, it sort of works. Now I told you the effect, maybe it's not going to work as strongly, but you can experiment on your kids or something or your neighbors, you know, and do it with them.
Blindfold them. And yeah.
Exactly. Blindfold them, feed them M&Ms and ask them what they taste like. And this is the same principle as applies everywhere. Sort of your brain is pulling that information together and it's trying to send you different signals. Now, of course, there was a huge element there of also your experiences and your memories influencing how things go. So if you have a particular memory with a particular color or smell or taste or something, that is going to impact how you process the environment. And this is also where the cultural element comes in. You know, in certain cultures, certain colors or again, smells or sounds have a certain meaning. But generally, the principle of pulling these senses together and creating a much stronger experience, it really, really applies. And this is also why very often you will go to a restaurant, for example, and there is music there. And if there is no music there, it just feels awkward. Mm. And you go to a restaurant and if it has lively music, it's immediately telling you, you know, what it's going to be like. If it has calmer music, maybe something that is a bit more relaxing, it's immediately telling you how things are going to taste. So yeah, you can definitely use it. You can definitely play it around, you know, by yourself using your phone and whatnot, and experiment.
That's great. When you think of it, for example, for restaurants design, right, like even the color of the plates or the texture of the plates. I remember reading a study about how people rate coffee in different colors of cups. And It's just amazing that people rate the black cup to be more bitter and the red one tasted better. And it's the same coffee. And it's really interesting when it comes to designing 3D environments, like spatial designs that we are inside of them, yeah. And how we behave in those spaces and how it all shapes our experiences of the world.
Oh my God, yes.
If we look at the workspace, our focus levels, and if we look at how we connect to each other, like if the surface is hard or soft, and what is the temperature of the light, and what is the position of the light, that's so interesting to play with. And we can, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I think this sort of, again, going back to what we saw, like this connection to nature, I think when I learned about the impact of lights and how that changes your focus and your concentration, I was just mind blown because I never thought about it. I would, you know, when I was a kid, my mom would just buy the light bulb in the house and then, you know, you roll with it. It is what it is. It's a light bulb. And then I learned that, you know, sort of, again, light bulbs we've only had for a very short amount of time. If we go back in evolution and how we grew up with nature, we would wake up and we would go to bed with a different type of light. It's soft light, warmer light in the mornings and in the evenings. It's much colder, brighter, sharper lights in the middle of the day. And then when you think about the fact that our brains and bodies got adapted to that, sort of think about just, you know, think how you feel if you ignore the light bulbs in your house. Think how you feel when you wake up. You are more relaxed, kind of your body feels maybe like it's a little bit more, you know, soft and cottony and, you know, it's floating. And it's the same in the evening when you're tired. And then during the day, you generally tend to feel much more alert and much more focused. And this is, of course, again, connected to how we used to hunt, how we used to gather our food, how much time we had during the day. So now when we look at the environments where we live and the fact that our offices just have white light all throughout and you get out of your office and it's 8:30 in the evening and you've spent now, you know, 10 hours under white light, of course your body is confused. It's not supposed to be that way. You were supposed to by now sit in soft lighting telling your body that, you know, we've hunted for today, we've done a great job, it's time to relax, it's time to wind down, but your body doesn't get that signal. And it's just, I think it's just incredibly frustrating that we have that power to help ourselves sort of navigate the world that we've built. And it's a completely different discussion, you know, that we have to sit in an office entirely. And I think, Addy, you're probably one of the best people to talk about the fact that it doesn't have to be that way. But for a lot of us that do have to do that, that do have to sit in the office, it's just so frustrating that this opportunity to at least do things like utilize different color brightnesses and different light colors, it's just not there. And we can really do that. And one of the things we did in my house was install smart lights that we can play around with and like change you know, the warmth of it and the brightness of it, but also just get creative with all sorts of different colors. That's made a huge difference. We have one of my favorite parts is we have one of those color changing light bulbs in the bathroom, and shower time just got so much more fun because sometimes if I'm feeling like, you know, particularly upset or tired during the day, I just go in and I make my light bulbs, you know, maybe blue. I love color blue. Here's a fun fact. Apparently color blue is like the most preferred color in the world by everyone. It's something like 40% for men and 25% for women. So I'm one of those people. I love blue and I will make the color blue shine in my bathroom. And it just immediately makes me think of like, you know, the ocean, and it relaxes me and it brings up those great feelings. And I just cannot imagine, you know, taking a shower in the evening before going to bed in white, sharp, surgical light. And it's just so powerful. It's such an easy change and it makes such a huge difference.
It is. It felt like a shift in culture. There's a really interesting essay by a Japanese author called In Praise of Shadows that talks about the difference between Japan and the West and what it is like to live in an environment that is not fully lit and how it affects the way you process information. And it allows more abstract thoughts, pretty much. And what it's like for us to live in a very bright world. I just came from a few weeks in the Nordics. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to see how the concept of light is changed there. Because some parts of the year, there is darkness and they're not trying to fight it.
Yeah.
You know, even the streets are not fully lit the way we know in other cities. It's much more subtle. And I guess that their bodies are also adapting to the light in a different way. Yeah. That's really interesting too. So when we look at it, it's almost like short term versus long term, right? So we can push through having a overhead light, fluorescent, very bright, but it will take its toll in the night or tomorrow when we're not rested enough. Yeah, I'm really curious to hear your opinion about where you think it's going in terms of like the future or trends or things that you notice in your work.
Yeah, I think you kind of mentioned one of crucial moment is the short-term thinking versus long-term thinking. And this is something that is pervasive, I think, everywhere, particularly like we mentioned at the beginning, you know, in our culture, which is consistently chasing, you know, profits, not always in monetary terms, very often in monetary terms, but it's consistently chasing, you know, profits, productivity, producing more, doing more. And I think this is changing. This is slowly changing because there is also the realization that you cannot chase profits. Or rather, let's put it that way. If you want to chase profits, you also have to do that in a sustainable way. You know, like, and then there is also a realization that, okay, maybe you shouldn't be chasing those kinds of profits and the productivity as the goal whatsoever. But I think that is kind of like the next step. And I think what we are seeing generally as a change in trends and in how things are being perceived is this understanding that no matter how much you're trying to drive profits forward or whatever it is that you're trying forward, there is a human in the middle of it, and there is a person in the middle of it that needs to be taken care of, that needs to be nurtured, that needs to grow. You know, you cannot get a lot of value out of a person that is wilted inside. So there is a desire to help people grow. Again, I think it's very important to mention here that there was a huge difference between how the Western world that does have the extra money and the extra opportunities sort of tries to push for that versus maybe some other countries that do not have the luxury of doing that. They're still very much burdened by the Western drive for profits. But once again, this is a different discussion. Yes, I feel like we could have so many discussions, you know, out of this.
Yes, we can.
But in the sort of
we can.
Yeah, but in the Western world where we do have the luxury to try and focus back on the human, I think it's beautiful to see that we're slowly making that progress. And there is both a change towards kind of sustainable production in terms of the planet, but there's also a change in sustainable production towards the human. And I think one of the ways in which that manifests itself is how much we're changing our understanding of, for instance, what an office space should look like. This is also like, it's a super interesting one because I can, you know, tell you everything I can about how to manage your home and you can change your home the way it works for you. But one of the things that we have very little power to change, at least in some stages of our life, is the environments where we work. And it's really... It's funny and it's absurd that we spend most of our time in an office space without an opportunity to actually, you know, be nurtured in it and grow and love it. So it's great to see that there is that shift, and that shift being that, you know, people need senses. People cannot sit in a white cubicle all day. On the flip side of that, people also cannot sit in an open space all day. And we saw, like, historically speaking, there was also changes to that. I think like in the 1980s, it was cubicles. Then, you know, fast forward like 10, 20 years, people were like, oh no, wait, we want open spaces and collaboration. Today, there was actually some desire to go back again to having that privacy and that individual space so you don't get sensorially overwhelmed. And I think there is more and more of that understanding that people are people, that people need to have their senses nurtured and stimulated and they have to grow with them. There was also an understanding that each individual is different. And I think this is a beautiful change. Again, highlighting that this is in the Western world where we have the privilege to do that. But we are trying to push forward sort of an environment in which each individual, regardless of how they function and what they need, their cultural background, their experiential background, can have a work environment or a space environment in which they can grow best. And that's really cool to see. And particularly in offices, for instance, that is manifested by having some sort of, you know, middle ground between cubicles and meeting rooms and open spaces and maybe quiet corners and sensory rooms. But it's definitely going there. I think the future of it would be just much more understanding in the same direction that people are human, and I cannot emphasize that sort of hard enough, and they're all different. And all of the sensory processing and sensory sort of integration of different experiences sometimes can also lead to overwhelm. And that everybody needs a sort of individual approach, and that takes money and that takes time for companies. And I'm hopeful that they will eventually, you know, reach a conclusion that it's worth it from the profits perspective as well. But first and foremost, from the perspective that we're people and, you know, we're human. But I think it is moving in that direction.
That sounds great. You know, it's funny, right? Because in that Western perspective, we're all the same, we all have the same, even between men and women, right? Like NASA not having spacesuits for women until I think the 90s or so, because we're like different body sizes and all. But also when we approach work and we see different kind of work, we have deep work, we have creative work, we have the fact that we can't sit in front of a desk for 10 hours a day. This is not how we think best, then maybe we should start encouraging people to get up and move in the space and choose what kind of work they want to engage with right now and design for that.
Yeah.
and designed for different minds and different bodies.
Yeah.
So instead of flattening culture and human, if I hear you correctly, you say that we're going to have to accommodate many more types of thoughts or human beings.
Yeah, for sure. You're right. It's this also understanding that everybody is unique. And it's, I think, a very difficult thing to process very often because it's deeply rooted of how we've treated people throughout history. Throughout history, there was a lot of us versus them. And us is, you know, it's group psychology. Us is a group, therefore we must all be the same. And them is a group, therefore them must all be the same. And there was a lack of understanding that everybody is individual. And very luckily for us, the world is moving in that direction. And, you know, it's in the power of each one of us to try and drive that change forward. And this with itself brings an understanding that you cannot treat all of the people as the same. You need to give people the space to individually explore. You have to give people the space to have what they sensorially need. So for example, I know that I love working in a busy environment. I love working in coffee shops. I love working when there is chaos. In my office, I never sit at a desk. I always sit in the cafeteria. And that is because for my particular brain, that stimulates my creativity. That stimulates me thinking. It evokes all of those emotions. What is maybe for some people overstimulates my brain and that makes me feel great. Whilst I fully understand that if you were to put somebody, you know, else in that environment, they would go crazy because it would be just too much for them. It would be too distracting. And similarly, if I have to sit in a quiet room, I just fall asleep. It just does not work for me. I cannot deal with it. I need that sensory overdrive. So I think generally companies, but also it's really important to also understand that I think in like relationship world, like, you know, with your friends or with your family, the understanding that everybody's unique and everybody has different needs and every brain processes things through the unique lens of their own biology, chemistry, experiences, memories, cultures, and whatnot allows us to really harvest the most out of each one of our experiences and create communities that are more synergistic and that are more supportive of each other. And sort of sometimes when I talk about, you know, how today there was a push for, you know, more flexible work, be it remote, be it in the office. Very often right now you'll read articles that say, we need to go for remote work. And I'm like, if I had to be remote, I would die. I don't know. I need to be in the office. I need to be in the chaos. So, you know, there's different ways to handle it. And sort of when we talk about that, people very often say, oh, but we've always had this, or we've always said that. And I try to remind them that, you know, we've also not had a 40-hour week until about 100 years ago, even less than that. We've had to work way more, and we've had to work with kids as kids. And now things are changing, and it's beautiful, and it's not a sign of something bad. Change is great, particularly when it is recognizing the individual needs and the diversity of needs. And I think that is really, really cool.
It is. You know, I find it quite interesting, and I would love to hear your opinion. So there are those patterns that we all share as human beings that evolved in the same way. But then we have all those individual personal memories and culture backgrounds and all that. So how do you find the sweet spot when designing for human beings in general?
Oh, that's a tough question. Let's try to unpack it live together. So let's take it step by step. So you're completely right. There were certain patterns that are fairly universal, and I will say universal sort of like with a caveat, of course, it's not, you know, the same for every single person, but it's generally large scale patterns that we see, like things, you know, with light that we discussed. You know, people tend to function better in colder light, in sharper light versus softer yellow light. There were certain things that are very deeply rooted in our biology. There was also, as you said, a lot of things that are rooted in our experience and in our I guess just how life went, things how we prefer. I think personally for me, and this is a very personal take on things, I'm sort of a big believer that everything happens, you know, in the brain. Everything is very physicalist. I'm a physicalist theorist in that sense, that, you know, the brain is responsible for everything. The brain is responsible for, you know, everything that we go through. And for me personally, I think the fundamental biology of who I am as a human is more important. Again, this is with a huge kind of, you know, warning sign that this is just my take. But I'm realizing that when I try to work through more of my like habits or things that I'm used through, I still think I'm trying to break away from the societally imposed need for how things have to be done. And I'm trying to get back to the roots of being sort of, you know, what it means to be a human very deep down. And sometimes when I'm designing I don't mean in a very doesn't have to be pictures, right? Like, it's not designing in a sense, mm-hmm. like making something look pretty, but functionally designing a situation or a space or workflow, I try to go back to, like, if I were to try and solve the same problems in a world that is not today, but in a world that is, like, you know, 50,000 years ago, and I was a cave woman or something like that, sitting in the nature, how would I approach those problems? What kind of things would be important to me? And I'm experiencing this personal shift of, I think, my connectedness to me as a human first, what it means to be biological, what it means to be connected to nature. You know, I think that is more prevalently important. So I think probably, and, you know, maybe we'll speak in a year and I will fundamentally change my mind. We'll see. But I would probably answer your question with saying that, like, I would try to always go back to the fact that human nature is incredibly strong. And that is not to say that individual experiences are not important. They absolutely are. They 100% are. And in some cases, they are more important than nature. But I do think that the forces of who we are as humans are just so powerful and so strong that designing for those as a baseline will allow you to create something that is sort of appropriate and can be accepted by many different people. Sort of in the most fundamental way. And then having, I guess, modifications or opportunity for individual modifications for people who have certain experiences that change how they go through the world is also fantastic. But yeah, I think having that human nature at its source is, for me, a fairly good way to try and build something that is fundamentally appropriate for us as, you know, as biological animals as we are.
That's a great answer. You really nailed it.
We'll see. Ask me that, as I said, ask me that question in a year. We'll see what I tell you.
Okay, I will. I'm gonna put it in my calendar. That's great. So, you know, many of the listeners of this podcast have this dream of starting a project, or they are founders of projects. And if you had to help them get into that mindset, what are the questions that are important to ask? Or what would be your advice for them other than start with humans?
Right. So I think one of the also very crucial things when we are building whatever it is that we're building, be it a workspace, an app, a movie production, I don't know, whatever that is being very certain about what we're trying to achieve. Because I think that intentionality and that sort of understanding of what is the final thing that you want people to experience is also what helps you to pick the right senses to engage, is what helps you to pick the right words to use and the right memories and emotions to evoke. I think, and this is me sort of, like, I guess, taking off my sensory person hat and putting on my product making hat. Very often we first come up with solutions and we have an idea for, like, oh my God, this would be really cool. And then we just build that, whatever that might be. Or, like, I would love to put, you know, this picture in my bedroom or something like that. I have this empty wall in my bedroom and I've been thinking for a really long time, like, what should I put up there? And, you know, we'll be like, oh, this is a nice picture. I'm going to put it in my bedroom. But I think it's really important to sort of flip it on its head and think about, like, what is it that you want to achieve? You know, when I'm sitting in my bedroom, what is it that I want to feel? What is it that I want to feel every morning when I wake up and I look at that empty wall? How do I want to feel? What emotions do I want to have? What is the problem that I want to solve? Do I wake up, you know, feeling sad or tired or anxious? And how can I use my senses to help me with that? So to give you a specific example, in my bedroom, I have two walls and one of them is empty. And on the other one, I put a cat wall for my cats because I love my cats. And I realized that I want a little bit more of that joy of looking at my cats run around. And even if they're not on that wall every morning I wake up, it just the imagery of that and that brain, you know, going like, oh my God, the cat was sitting there yesterday or it's going to sit there in 5 minutes. That brings me a lot of joy. And I would have never otherwise thought about putting a cat wall in my bedroom because that's just ridiculous. But it's the joy that I was after every morning as I wake up. So I think that understanding that human emotion is essentially what drives everything and what emotion you want to evoke is so crucial to building anything at all. What problem you want to solve, et cetera, et cetera. It all ties down to what emotion you want people to feel in particular situation. And then understanding that emotions are not one directional. So very often I will hear sort of when people come to me, maybe for advice or something like that, I'll hear people say something like, you know, I've identified a problem, people want to do X, but they cannot. So I've built them the functional thing, which is an app, and it has 26 buttons and stuff like that. And it's all great, it's all functional, but it's ignoring the fact that, you know, there was a whole human brain, there was a whole human experience behind it. And it's just not getting touched. It's forgotten. And you're trying to target something in a person, forgetting that they are a person. You're trying to sell them something, treating them as if they were a wallet that just automatically, you know, takes out the $5 bill and gives it to you in exchange for whatever product you made. But there are so many emotions and so many feelings that you can make people feel. And if we, from a very pragmatic perspective, we look at the history of products, the products that have been most successful is the products that makes us feel. It's the products that make us experience that wealth of emotions and that wealth of sensory things. Think of, you know, one of the sort of most prominent, probably successful examples of today's world. Think of Apple and iPhones and whatnot. Like when you think of an iPhone, you think of what it feels like. You don't just think of, you know, what it looks like, what it feels like. Physically speaking, right? Like, what does it feel like on your fingers? Maybe if you've ever bitten on your iPhone, I do this sometimes, you know what it feels like on your teeth. If you've been in an Apple store, you know what it smells like. And think about any other random phone. Like, sometimes it's very difficult to imagine those things. So I think understanding that a human brain needs that wealth of sensory experiences is really important. I sort of wanted to also bring up here, there was this concept called like experiential deprivation or experiential impoverishment, which it came from, or like sensory deprivation. It came from very specific studies with dogs actually. And it essentially dealt with like, if you sensorially deprive animals, how do they develop? So it was very basic science, nothing to do with humans. And then this concept slowly came into the human world. And it essentially was saying that today is saying that in how we've built our world for a variety of reasons, cultural, historical, economic, we've made our world very much sensorially empty. Sort of think about a newly built cities. I think this is something that's particularly prevalent in the US, for instance, because in Europe we have the, you know, older architecture, but if you go into the US or like the newly built cities, or if you think about fashion shows, trends, think about the cars on the street, even think about the iPhone. Everything is sort of so bland. It's so empty. There's not a lot of richness to it. And this sensory deprivation, this deprivation of sensory stimulation, of information coming at us in a coherent, in a harmonious way, in different directions to send us a message, it's just not there. And it makes us feel nothing. Like, sometimes I'll go into an H&M and I just feel nothing because everything is white and everything is blue and, you know, it doesn't have that. And then you maybe go into your grandma's closet and it has all of those colors and it has all of those textures and it has all of those shapes. And you're like, oh my God, this is exciting. So I think that understanding that we have as a culture, and it's kind of, you know, rooted in our understanding of, you know, sexualities and genders and meanings of shapes. It also has to do a lot with colonialism, but you know, this is again a different story. All of those things and our certain ideas of what it means to be sophisticated or elegant or pure or Western have led us to live in a world that is just bland and sensorially deprived. And that is an opportunity we're missing. I think people are craving something. I think people are craving stimulation. They might sometimes not feel okay saying that because we've built a culture that demonizes sort of brightness and powerful emotions and powerful senses. But I think deep down people are craving that. And when you are building something, understanding that you can tap into the people's deepest desires for being stimulated and almost, you know, seduced through different senses can give you that really unique edge. So sort of to give, you know, TLDR of everything that I just said, I think if you're trying to build something, whatever that might be, selling something, non-selling something, profits, non-profits, products, experiences, think about the emotions that you want people to feel when they are interacting with your idea. And think about all of the senses that they are not getting stimulated today, and then they could get stimulated, and how much emotion and how much experience you can evoke in them. And I think that can really give everyone a unique perspective and also a very advantageous perspective, because you'll give people what they truly need, even if they don't necessarily always understand it.
You put it out in such a beautiful way. We talk about it in urban design. Do you know how when you go to travel, you always go to the old city and not the new city? And you touched on that. And there's also something about the way we move in the world. We used to walk everywhere, so we had more time to experience the environment. But when we drive in a car and there's a lot of details, it's actually kind of dangerous. So more blank environments are actually more suitable for cars than to people. And in certain streets, you walk and you feel like there's nothing to experience. You get a bit bored, you know, that feeling. So that's exactly it. It's so interesting that you brought it up. At first, I thought you were going to talk about floating tanks, you know?
Yeah, oh my God.
Like being sensory deprived, which is also interesting for the brain.
Yeah.
But yeah, we can go for hours. And I think we're almost out of time. No, I know. Can we do another 5 minutes?
Yes, of course. We have time, yeah.
Okay, great. So yeah, then there's also like this other end of the scope where we go into floating tanks and intentionally depriving our senses to maybe go back inwards and find something there. Have you ever tried that, by the way?
So I've never tried a sensory deprivation tank, but I've always really, really wanted to. I have to admit that I'm sometimes afraid of that because, as I mentioned, I love this, you know, chaos. And I think one of the reasons I love chaos is because I think it balances with the chaos in my mind. And I'm a little bit afraid. And I think that doesn't speak to the fact that sensory deprivation tanks are bad. I think they're actually fantastic. But I think because I still, you know, live in this world, which doesn't always allow much space for your head to just be, I'm actually afraid of what would happen if I went into one. And there's another thing that I've always wanted to do, and that is a silent retreat. And my boyfriend always laughs when I say that because I have ADHD, which means that for me to be quiet, it's just torture, as you probably heard in the past hour. Like, I cannot be quiet. But I am like really curious as to what would happen if I just had to be silent, if I just let my body and my brain absorb all of the things from the outside and from the inside. And there was this thing called the, what's it called? Ganzfeld, I think, effect it's called, or something like that. The Ganzfeld effect, which is essentially saying that, like, if you put people through a lot of, you know, monotonous sensory simulation, like a monotonous color all around or a like white noise for a long enough time, people will start experiencing hallucinations. And essentially, a hypothesis as to why this is happening is because our brain is trying to fill that in. It's trying to fill those gaps in. It doesn't understand why, you know, why is there no actual activity going on? So it's trying to fill those gaps in. And that is because it craves to make sense of the world. It craves to experience things. And you can really, I think, you know, have fun with it. You can really push yourself. I think this is also kind of one of the reasons why sometimes there is an allure in maybe taking, you know, hallucinogenic or psychedelic drugs, because it allows you to experience that other dimension that just the world that we live in doesn't let you do that. So sometimes, you know, I imagine myself, I think I would love to be some sort of, you know, I don't know, shaman, or maybe not a shaman, maybe live with a shaman somewhere in the woods and just, you know, try to let my brain wander, being stimulated by all the natural senses. That just sounds so, it just sounds so magical. And I try to create, you know, as close as it gets to those experiences in my real world. And I think everyone should. And, you know, you inspired me sort of to say, you know what, maybe I'm actually going to go into the sensory deprivation tank sometime soon, because I'm very curious.
Maybe we can go together while I'm in Berlin. It'd be fun.
We should.
I actually went once and it was such an interesting
experience. How was it? How did you feel it?
It was really interesting. It was in Lisbon, and it's this egg pool, and they let you control some of it, right? So you can choose how much light you'll have. You can have music on or off. But then after a while, so at first I was like, I'm floating in water. It's so interesting. I'm in the dark. And then slowly I let go of the music and the light, and I just heard my breathing, which was really interesting. Yeah. And my mind was like, blah, 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 analyzing this. And after a while, because I took an hour, after a while, it just got quiet.
Wow.
And it was really interesting to experience that. And the effect was, I felt it mostly after trying to get back out to the street and realizing how much is going on there. I literally, I had to put my hoodie on and walk very slowly to my apartment, trying not to engage with anything because I was so sensitive after that. So it's very interesting experience.
That sounds really cool.
It is. It is. Well, I really enjoyed what you just said about creating those experiences that people miss, like trying to tap into that, because it's almost like seeing a need in the market, but we see need in human beings, at the way you described it.
Yeah.
Natalia, thank you so much for being with us today. Before we go, there is one last question that I ask all of my guests. But before, I want to thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
And to ask, where is the best way to follow you and connect with you and your work?
That's a great question. I actually do not lead any social media properly. I probably should, but I do not. And actually, one of the reasons is because I feel entirely overwhelmed with all of it. So if anybody wants to chat, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn anytime. I must give a sort of warning, because I have ADHD, I tend to be really, really, really bad at answering anything. So you might have to message me 26 times, but I will get back to you eventually. So reach out to me on LinkedIn. And I'll be happy to, you know, chat and just bounce ideas off. Always happy to do that.
Amazing. And I'll make sure to put the link in the show notes so it's easy to find. Okay, so we're reaching the final question. And it's called the wild napkin.
Wow.
So you go into a bar and you have a couple of drinks and your mind is very free. And all of a sudden you have the craziest idea. But all you have is a napkin, so you write it down. What does it say?
Oh, this is a tough one. What would my idea say?
So there is no budget limit or no time limit. There's a mysterious philanthropist who wants to fund your wildest idea.
I think one of my wild ideas would definitely be to allow everybody at least once to experience that freedom of connection with nature. So I would love to have an opportunity to create. You don't need a resort. There's enough nature in the world that is, you know, getting untouched for now, hopefully. I would just love to have some sort of opportunity, some program to get people out of whatever they're doing and just let them be part of nature and part of the, you know, the real world for just a little bit. So I think if I had one thing to create, I would create some sort of program that would enable everyone, at least once, to disconnect and really take in all of their senses and their connection with nature.
I love that. And when you're envisioning it, what kind of nature is it? Is it a jungle, a beach, an Arctic Circle? Like, what do you say?
I think for me, it would be a cliff. I love oceans and cliffs. But, you know, whatever rocks your boat, whatever each one of you needs, I think that's good.
Okay, that sounds super interesting. Thanks for sharing. I would love to get disconnected and go into your what you just created. Thanks for sharing. And thanks everyone who joined us today. And until the next time, go out and talk to strangers.
It's my pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.